Hello, and welcome to another Ometown Daily News Show. I am Mayor Watt. That is ometown.com. I stream here on Twitch. I also copy it over to YouTube and to the podcast, all named Ometown. So if you do a search, you'll find Ometown on various podcast catchers, as well as over on Twitter and YouTube and here on Twitch. You can also go over and look at the news aggregator, which is what powers the Ometown Daily News Show. And hopefully in time, and I keep talking about it, but I haven't made much movement on it other than setting out future plans. I am hoping that I'll be able to stream all day today. I do have an appointment immediately after this, but I'll be back by 1 o'clock because I want to watch the Apple WWDC keynote. So with that in mind, let's get into today's news. I won't have much time to hang out before I have to leave and then come back in time for the keynote. Anyway, let's get into it. So what is Ometown? Ometown is a news aggregation site. All of the news gets funneled into six main categories, which I'm showing you across the top here. Create news, education, entertainment, social, and technology. Then in that, there are about 50 channels, sub-channels, where news gets funneled even deeper into niche areas that I am interested in, that I use in my daily life, in my professional life. And I use Ometown to keep me informed. And because it was very difficult to go out and find all of the sources in disparate locations, I aggregated into Ometown. And at the beginning of the year, I made it public for everybody. It's been around for quite a long time, but I've always kind of started it and stopped it, but now it's up and running and open to the public. So go over and sign up. If you don't like the site or you think that's something you should change, let me know and I'll consider making some effective changes. Now, that in mind, let's get into the news itself. The very first article is Razer's new eco logos will tell you just how green your new hardware is or how guilty you should feel. I, for one, will not feel guilty. Razer has once again made a step in a greener direction. No, I'm not talking about the retina destroying color of its peripherals. The company just announced that it's going to be slapping Type 1 Eco Logo sustainable product certifications from Underwriters Laboratories, or UL. And you'll find UL in its logo sitting on electronics. On two of its gaming mice, Razer's partner for this. UL is the same company that owns 3DMark. That's one of the tests we use to benchmark hardware in their labs over at PC Gamer. I'm going to go over to the link. There you go. And obviously, I just said it. The article is aggregated from PCGamer.com. The author of the article is Katie Wickens. And the Death Adder Essential and Basilisk V3 will be getting a fancy green badge, with the V3 also receiving a refresh in the process. So, let's see if they get into it. So, to put your mind at ease, this is the article and the author stating what it's all about. So here are the six hoops Razer had to jump through to meet official public standards and get that certification. The supply chain complies with EU's restriction of chemicals candidate list or REACH. The product is dermally biocompatible, i.e. the materials won't damage your skin, and it complies with the restricted hazardous substances in electrical and electronic products, or ROSE directive. It's a low energy consumption device. Well, like the author says, they hope so, it's from a mouse. End of life management is up to scratch. That's their terminology. All of this is their editorializing, because this isn't what's in the certification language. But end of life management is up to snuff. You can recycle or send them back for reuse. Oh, and Razer is going to make repair parts available even 3 years after end of life. Well, this is kind of like a long-term viability metric. Heavy metals, no heavy metals or chlorine are used in the packaging. Chlorine is really bad. It off-gasses over time, and a lot of poor oversight can lead to using chlorine in production methods. And while somebody can say, well, there's no chlorine in the end product, it's actually in the end product. It's just off-gassing over time. There was a company here in the States that actually got pretty much crushed because their flooring was sold and it still was off-gassing chlorine, like wildly off-gassing chlorine. Let's see. And the writer also says, the author of the article also says, then there's the corporate side of things. Razer's sustainability reports are made publicly available. Then there's the screened conflict mineral policy, as well as a take-back program that gives vouchers for the return of old products. And that goes into the other thing about the end-of-life management. And I think all of this is great. I have absolutely no concern with this. I used to have a product from Razer that the padding for the headset, for the headphones, you know, the thing that goes on your head itself, not on your ears, that started to decompose and flake, and it was really weird. And so I ended up just throwing them out. They were the Krakens, I think they were called, the 7.1s. Yeah, after that, actually, I ended up going in a completely different direction. I want a split keyboard. I use a trackball, not a mouse. I feel I can do... Wow, sorry about that smack. I must be dehydrated or something. I use a split keyboard and I use a trackball. I don't really like mice all that much. I wish that there was enough dedication to the ergonomics of even game playing, but that's really, it doesn't seem to be the primary concern, at least in my observation, my opinion of this. I would love split keyboards to become the standard, and I would cheerlead switching to split keyboards and trackballs all the time. If somebody would just make a high quality but inexpensive mechanical split keyboard. The best that I've got right now is the Mistel split keyboards. And I don't know, I wouldn't call it a really feature rich. And I can hear the springs in my Mistel, but anyway. And then my trackball is a Deft, and that thing has some weird switch problem with it. So I'm kind of falling apart all around. But let's go on. Let's continue on. And it's not like this equipment was cheap. It's just kind of, I don't know, disappointing. Anyway, the next article is in the Smack Talk channel, what to expect from WWDC 2022 and what not to. Apple's annual worldwide developer conference is today for 2022. So it starts today on June 6th and runs until I think the 10th. Here's what you can expect to see an Apple unveil. So I'm just going to go straight over to Apple Insider. That's where that article is aggregated from. Oh, you know what? I'm falling apart. I didn't throw it in chat. So sorry about that. Let me throw it in chat real quick. Doink. If you are visiting or you are looking at this on YouTube or in the podcast, the show notes will link you to the articles by way of Ohmtown. So you just drive through Ohmtown and take the visit the source off ramp, and there you go. So Malcolm Owen over at appleinsider.com writes what you should expect to hear from WWDC today. It's going to be at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific. And let's see if they're going to talk about it. OS updates, iOS, iPadOS, macOS, watchOS, tvOS. Apple broke it out for whatever reason, so that they could have custom OSs for each one of the platforms instead of, I guess, a consensus across all of them, which I guess is fine. I mean, you can't have tvOS on your watch. It's just chunkier, so you need that space. Although nowadays, even my watch has a ton of storage, so I'm not really, I don't know, I'd rather have it all one unified update. But that's, again, just me. I do work in the software computer science sector, but I'm not a software engineer by any stretch. So they know what they're doing, that's for sure. That's just what makes them a multi-billion dollar company, trillion dollar company. The main platform for Apple to talk about is always iOS, and 2022 is no exception. The easiest and most obvious thing to determine is the name, which, unless Apple changes it, is going to be iOS 16 or iPadOS 16. This is all the author talking in the article. They reference Mark Gurman. It says by May 29th, Gurman offered more detail, including how a software feature will enable an always-on display in the iPhone 14 Pro line by reducing the refresh rate down to 1 hertz. I suppose that's brilliant. I don't know many people that would always have it on, though. But 1 hertz compared to upwards of 120, I think is, if that saves the battery, and then so be it. Let's get really close to e-paper, where it's always on, but it's static until another charge comes through. I guess that's about as close as you can get with 1 hertz of a refresh rate. But backlighting is really the thing that sucks all of the energy down. So maybe they'll address that too. Says the screen lock is also apparently a target for changes, with promises of quote unquote wallpapers that have widget-like capabilities. Sounds good. They talk about macOS 13, another iteration of the desktop OS, tvOS 16, watchOS 9. I'm really excited about the next iteration of the Apple Watch. It'll have some more technology expanding its monitoring capabilities. I really wish that there was a blood pressure version of watch band that was reliable, or I mean, there are solutions out there, I suppose, but I haven't found one that I like that's integrated straight into the watch band. At any rate, the next iteration of the watch is supposed to have sharper edges, not the rounded edges, look more like the new aesthetic in the Apple laptop line and iPad, iPhone line, that return to the square chunky style, which I've always liked much more than the rounded one. But they both have their a beautiful aesthetic if you're into industrial design. Apple Silicon, the introduction of M2, which is the next generation of M chips that are designed and built in-house by Apple. I think that will actually continue the micronization of the chip, making it more powerful, faster, more reliable. Anything that shortens the distance between the components within the chip means that it's going to be faster, more energy efficient as well. At some point, they'll break the physics where ions, electrons, just kind of skip from one place to another. And that causes problems. But they are, again, the experts, and they'll be able to figure it out. Insulation layers or something, I'm not sure. And they're talking about like the aesthetics and whatnot, but I'm not too hip on the rumors about that kind of stuff. I'm more interested in the hardware itself. What's going to come out? The aesthetics will be apparent once they see once it's shown. And so it's so subjective that I'm not too worried about color and whatnot. But the industrial design means a lot to me, as well as that the specifications inside the devices. They talk about the Mac Pro, the last segment of Apple's Mac business, not to have been given the Apple Silicon treatment. A Mac Pro has a lot of potential for a Worldwide Developer Conference unveiling. I don't know, with the Apple Studio, I think the Mac Pro might be kind of stepping out. We'll see. It has a lot of momentum, so that kinetic energy will keep it floating along for quite some time. And here is what I am hoping the most for: AR, VR, and Reality OS. It says, for years, Apple has been rumored to be working on augmented reality, virtual reality, mixed reality headsets, and Apple Glass smart glasses. Depending on the speculation at hand, there have been so many claims about technology over time that it seems inevitable that Apple will show something off. And I certainly hope so. I hope that they're not the ones that keep getting rendered, which are goggles. Obviously, those are more in line with VR. But if they are augmented Apple Glass, where I can put them on like my prescription glasses, which I say don't get old, folks. It's inevitable, but if you can avoid it, let me know the secret. Everything was fine until I turned 30. And then, wow, it just went. When you go to a doctor and your doctor says, well, Mayor, your warranty is up, it makes you flinch. But hey, it's inevitable. So I guess I need to embrace it and not talk about it on the podcast or on the stream or over on the YouTube channel. Oh my gosh, I'm talking about it everywhere. Anyway, hoping that Google Glass is the augmented reality glasses and it can be applied to any prescription lens or any lens in general, and superimpose computer graphics wherever I look based on the GPS or some type of hardware anchor. So I can put something either in a shop, or in my office or around the house or whatever, it doesn't matter, even on me, a name badge that actually projects my stat block, bunk out there in the world for everybody who has Apple Glass, or at least Reality OS. Love the name too, Reality OS. I have a channel that I want to bring to Twitch called Reality Hacker, which is all about augmented reality, virtual reality, mixed reality, which is basically AR and VR. Anyway, love the idea of hyper realistic computer graphics, deep fakes and whatnot. I've mentioned it a couple of times in my streams that back in the day, yo, I used to be able to program using something as simple as Python, the ability to take written word and somebody's spoken word and map out the phonemes. I learned it from an artificial intelligence professor, and I don't have the code anymore. I'd have to go and hunt it down. I still haven't found the code. But now there's so many solutions out there because it's been more than a decade that I did it. And there are people that are much more passionate about it. So now you have deep fakes of voice, deep fakes of graphics, deep fakes of both of them combined. It's going to be impossible to know who you're really talking to in virtual space. And therefore, the catchphrase for Reality Hacker is you won't know who to trust, which is a little ominous, maybe dystopian in nature, but that's the nature of Reality Hackers, the mythos that I want to actually keep in mind. Because you're going to have to trust but verify. You're going to have to make sure that the people that you are interacting with are who they say they are, or at least trust them in their anonymous state online in VR space or even right now. When VTubers, when they are using hyper-realistic avatars to the point where you can't tell if they are human or computer, That is going to be the pinnacle of reality hacking. So we're going to keep on watching the space, and for hopefully the next 30 years of my existence, we'll be paying attention to it. So it says, as for how much it could cost customers, Apple's headset is a decidedly premium product, which will most likely cost more than $1,000 and maybe as high as $3,000. Because I am suggesting that I could handle $1,000. You know, I could take that hit for the benefit of Apple Glass augmented reality with lenses, right? With prescription lenses. But $3,000, man, that is going to be a punch to the gut if they want $3,000 for AR. VR, unless it is spectacular in a field of view and the resolution, I can't imagine. And completely wireless, if it's tethered to something, then $3,000 is too much. But at any rate, then they switch over at the Apple Insider article, they switch from what they will show or what they hope to show to what they won't show. And it says, when analyzing speculation surrounding an Apple event, it can be hard to determine what may or may not be shown. It's usually relatively easy, as Apple is quite predictable about what products it launches at specific times of year. I don't think that is actually the case anymore. I don't think that it's going to be obvious. It'll always have a one more thing kind of a mentality to it, to catch people off guard. Or there's the depth of it that won't really be known. So it says, you're not likely to see things consumers will buy in stores unless it's hardware that's sufficiently novelty to give developers a heads up about. So consumer facing hardware for Apple's VR or AR headset is not likely to debut at WWDC. Yeah, I'm not sure about that. I mean, if they show anything about AR or VR that's embedded in Reality OS, then they will be highlighting some hardware to take advantage of that hardware. So let's continue on. The next article, I spent a considerable amount of time on that. The next article is in the Daily News Show, small study on rectal cancer results in remission in every patient. So this is a really small study. I'm interested in the field, the articles over at the New York Times, the study was small and experts say it needs to be replicated, but for 18 people with rectal cancer, the outcome led to quote unquote happy tears. So Sasha Roth, the first patient in the trial, unexpectedly learned that she had rectal cancer in 2018. Her gastroenterologist, she recalled, told her during a sigmoidoscopy, "Oh no, I was not expecting this," which is never good for you to hear from your doctor, as you can imagine. Well, this article, again, is over at the New York Times, written by Gina Colata. I've read this. I've read about it in other areas. This was aggregated by Ometown over from New York Times. So I haven't really read this particular article, but I've read the paper and I've read other recitations of the data. And this is remarkably this is remarkably remarkable. This is above any possible expectation and something. So I can't say that I am a professional in this sector. I can't say that my world of knowledge in this domain is spectacular, but I've never heard of a study where even of a small set, all members end up having what might as well be, they refer to it as complete remission in every single patient. But the way that this is spoken of makes it sound like it completely annihilated anything having to do with the cancer, i.e. there's no remnants, there's no nothing. There's no, they didn't even mention that there was high white blood counts or white blood cell counts or some other element that is usually present as an indicator of increasing cancer presence or decreasing cancer presence. Usually with somebody, as far as my understanding is, that when there is a person that has had cancer and it's gone into remission, there is still some indicator that suggests that something has happened, right? There's damage that has been done in one place or another. There's chemical indicators that show that you have had cancer. And it's usually not just a one-time thing. You have to see a trend. But this wiped it out, apparently, right? Total remission, all 18, undetectable by physical exam, endoscopy, PET scan, MRI scan. So nothing, gone. And they even use the term obliterated a cancer in every patient. So this is remarkable. And I hope that it leads to a greater deployment of this solution. But everybody's cancer is personal. It's built off of their genetics. It's not just some, you know, there's indicators of a, each cancer is similar, but it is still unique to each individual. And so not every treatment except for chemo, and even chemo is resisted by different people at different capabilities, but chemo is very destructive to the human condition. It basically wipes out everything in the immune system so that it wipes out everything that might be supporting the cancer cell growth. Well, at any rate, there are these checkpoint inhibitors that they're talking about. The person that spearheaded this kept getting denied. Eventually, a small company said, let's do it. They do it. They get this result. And now I hope that it gets applied to a greater number of people to see if it can be replicated, to see if this particular process allows more people to hit a safety zone in the fight against their personal cancer. So, because it's unsettling to get that notification either personally or even as a family member, a bystander, it is a shock to the system. So good luck to the efforts to fight this cancer. Let's hope that it doesn't go up in price, because at $11,000 a dose and you only need it for about $250,000 worth, I think that it's actually pretty darn cheap. So let's go on to the next article. Five new Steam games you probably missed for June 6, 2022. I won't spend a lot of time on this one. It's over in the Warcrafters channel, but it was aggregated from PC Gamer. Let's go straight over to PC Gamer and give some credit to Sean Prescott for putting this together. Sorting through every new game on Steam so you don't have to is what their statement is. You can go over and read more about it, but there's Leap, which launched into early access last week. Leap is a 60-player online FPS with a focus on high mobility. I love games like this. Back in the day, again, I wanted to spin up a role-playing game, a tabletop RPG, where you were a superhero. And it was set in feudal Japan, and so you could do these massive leaps and huge movements, and it was just really vertical, but it was all imaginary, right? Well, with computer games, you can take that vision and turn it into something. And so Leap is apparently really big on mobility, verticality, action. So the next one is Nemesis Lockdown. I haven't taken a look at it yet. It's based on the board game Nemesis. Lockdown is an online sci-fi horror about trying to escape from a base riddled with aliens. Then there's Soldiers, S-O-U-L-D-I-E-R-S, Soldiers. A side-scrolling Metroidvania, okay? with a heavy emphasis on RPG progression. Then there's Tiny Folks. I love these little games. One Steam review describes Tiny Folks as an Amiga version of Darkest Dungeon. All right. And you can go check out the prices over on Steam, but I would actually encourage you to go through Ohmtown over to and take the street that leads to PC Gamer in this particular article. Dwerve is getting a really big boost over on Twitch. A lot of people are digging this game. It says, here's more lushly detailed pixel art, this time in the format of an action adventure with tower defense elements, and Dwerve, a nasty witch queen, is causing a community of dwarves grief, and it's your job to fend off the bloodthirsty trolls she's sending in to do her bidding. So it says it's a top-down Zelda-like. I think it's like offset just a little bit at an angle to get some dimensionality. But what's really neat about it is you can just plop down turrets as you are going through your map. After they do their thing, you recover them and keep on moving through the map. It's a lot of fun to watch. So that's the six, but I don't think that people have missed Dwerve. The next article is in the Hatch Ideas channel, and this gets a little bit more real, I suppose you could say. Wheat, why India's export ban matters to the world. So India exports about 14%, maybe 15%. I don't remember the exact number, but I think it's somewhere around 14% of the world's wheat, and they've basically stopped it. India's move to ban exports rattled global markets, but the government says it won't have much impact, but it will. For instance, you know, here in the States, there was a company. This is a BBC article, by the way, by Shruti Menon. But here in the States, there was a company that makes infant formula, and they shut down one plant, and it impacted 25% of the sales of the production. So one company, and it disappeared from the shelves. Their product disappeared from the shelves, and they were very trusted up until this point. And they're just now spinning that back up, but it emptied the shelves. So imagine global sales, 14%, disappearing in a heartbeat simply because of a policy. It says, if everyone starts to impose export restrictions, that would worsen the crisis, German Food and Agriculture Minister Sem Özdemir said after the ban was announced in May. Yeah, and this happened mid-May. Right there. It says India's ban was announced on May 13th after unseasonably hot weather affected the wheat crop, sending local prices soaring. And so it actually started increasing beforehand, mainly because of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And then people started wanting to profiteer off of the pandemic. Basically, doors are opening back up around the world, and hence you start getting increases. Wheat is rather difficult to grow hyperlocal, so you know, it you need a lot of it from mass amounts of land, and it has to be open to the elements so that it's getting plenty of sunshine and so on and so forth. I don't think that you can grow it in your basement farm as a microgreen, but I think that it's more along the lines of this is a simple crop to grow nowadays. So hopefully everything will start picking back up. We have a problem with climate issues around the world. Things are getting hotter. Weather is getting more difficult to deal with. There's more hurricanes, apparently, more tornadoes. It's hotter than ever. It's colder in weirder, different locations than before. Things are getting colder further south, here in the States, at least. At least that's my interpretation of it. But this article over at BBC asked the question, who's been affected by India's ban? more than one might suspect, I would think. But definitely Africa, Asia, Middle East, some of Europe. So it says its top export markets are Bangladesh, Nepal, and Sri Lanka, as well as the United Arab Emirates. So there you go. 50% of their wheat. So Sri Lanka and UAE both imported more than 50% of their wheat from India, according to Observatory of Economic Complexity. And Nepal imported more than 90%. Well, they don't have the territory really to grow mass amounts of wheat. So they talk about bad weather and fertilizer prices. There has been this talk about fertilizer prices and being really high. That's a problem when there are fewer producers of fertilizer. That's the concentration. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about and when I soapbox about concentration, mergers and acquisitions. This influence over pricing. You know, people are like, oh, it's a good thing for mergers and acquisitions. No, it absolutely is not. When competition fades, that means that fewer controls are in place to fight off this lack of innovation, the lack of keeping the prices low. When competition is subsumed by a competitor, then you get fewer innovations, you get higher prices. It's unsettling that so much is controlled by so few. And it's all about money and power and influence. Okay, so let's continue on before I soapbox too long. The next article is in the Hatch Ideas channel. Google must pay a politician $515,000 for not taking down cyberbullying and vulgar videos about him, judge rules. So it says here, I think it's New South Wales, right? NSW. Deputy Premier John Barilaro sued Google for refusing to take down two videos that a judge later ruled were defamatory. Google must pay $515,000 to an Australian politician in a high-profile defamation case. John Barilaro sued the tech giant over two YouTube videos posted by a political commentator. A justice said that Google was complicit in refusing to take down the vulgar and racist videos. So here in the United States, it would be difficult to take those down. We have these First Amendment rights. And when you're a politician, it's even more difficult to take down anything that's even related to political speech. Not even the truth stands in the way of statements by the public, it seems, particularly when you're a politician. This article is over at businessinsider.com by Matthew Lowe. Let's see. The justice said that Google was complicit by refusing to take down the vulgar and racist videos. And let's continue on here. I'm not sure what all is going to be. It says that it came from a self-described comedian who runs a YouTube channel. They published various videos about Barilaro. Barilaro, yeah. But the court focused on two in particular. The first two makes fun of Barilaro for 26 minutes. That's some pretty serious dedication to making fun of a person. I don't need to reference the actual person that's in this. While both videos were edited after the person apologized to Barilaro in a settlement last year and paid $71,000 in damages, they're still available on YouTube. So the politician was accused of corruption, which the judge found to be false. Well, you'll never, unless the person has video of somebody, you know, taking a bribe or doing something overtly, it's going to be really darn impossible to find somebody guilty of corruption. If you're looking on the outside, Google itself had agreed that the YouTuber wrongfully suggested that Barilaro committed crimes, which included perjuring himself 9 times. Okay, stealing money from his local government and blackmailing local counselors, according to the court ruling. So that's what all of those videos were talking about. And I, you know, if it isn't demonstrably provable, if you cannot show that somebody is doing this and it isn't just open to interpretation, and you can't weather the storm of the lawsuit, then you just can't make those claims. So it says, they use racist and offensive words. I don't know about, oh, and yeah, I guess ways to describe somebody of Italian descent and so on. Yeah, I mean, it's vitriol, it's vindictive, it's and if again, if you beyond that, if you can't demonstrate the things that you are claiming, then you're gonna run afoul of some political, or I should say legal, structure somewhere, and you're just gonna end up in trouble. I mean, we have a global society nowadays. A statement made on YouTube or on Twitch ends up everywhere, and thus you potentially can run afoul of something somewhere. So it's this is really interesting that that Google ran afoul of Australian law based on a judge finding that it was defamatory. And I guess it's all a matter of safe harbor. If you don't do something when you've been shown that it's defamatory, guess what happens? Okay, so the next article is over in the Warcrafter channel. I have already spoken to it a little bit, but I'm going to reference it again. That Razer announced that it's a nice touch that makes two of its favorite mice even better. The Basilisk V3 and the Death Adder Essential have been given the Ecologic certification from, or sorry, Ecologo certification from UL. I'll even link to the source again, PC Gamer. Two different sources reporting about it. This is by Hope Corrigan over at PC Gamer. Let's continue on to the next article. Which is in the Hedge Ideas channel. Goldman Sachs says the US economy will slow to a crawl as the Fed hikes rates, but will dodge a recession. I don't know. Pardon me. It's hard to predict this, and it's pretty much a 50-50 chance at this point. The US economy will have to slow sharply, which the there's a really good chance that it's going to fall into a very bad recession because they, regardless of the slowing, people want to get ahead of it and make profit before the recession. Otherwise, you end up, and I think that it's going to go deeper than recession. But they're going to get ahead of it. It's going to cause an avalanche of pulling money from markets and stashing it in places that's more recession proof. And when that happens, something else is going to go up in value, but not at the same rate that money's getting pulled out. So, stock market's going to continue to crash. Inflation is going to continue going up, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's just the standard thing. And it's all about greed, really. Now, the U.S. economy will have to slow sharply. Pandemic-era drivers of inflation are likely to ease, making the Federal Reserve's job in taming prices easier, according to the bank's economists. Fears have grown in recent months that the Fed will have to hike hard, that it'll trigger a recession in the U.S. Well, they're going to kind of baby walk this down the line and hope that it doesn't stumble and fall. Now, this is an article over at Business Insider in a subsection that they call Markets Insider. and it's by Harry Robertson. And let's continue down here. Let's see. Fears have been growing in recent months that the Fed will have to hike rates so hard to tame inflation, which is running at 40-year highs. This is where I was talking about back in the 70s, late 70s, early 80s. It was a just massive inflation, at least for the U.S. It was an oil and gas shock. And we're talking like 12% inflation. And that just can't happen anymore. It's a global economy. Even in the U.S., it's a global economy. We're tied to so many other places to a greater degree than we ever have been. And so we will end up shocking the rest of the world if we go into recession. It will definitely impact other countries. It says, but Goldman analysts led by top economist, I don't know if it's Jan or Jan Hatzius, said in a note Monday that pandemic-linked drivers of inflation should soon fade, helping the Fed in its task of cooling prices. And they go into greater detail. It says analysts said they still expect the Fed to hike interest rates to between 3 and 3.25 by 2023 from the current 0.75 to 1% level. So how they're saying that this won't be a shock by 2023. So it falls in line with what I'm saying, that by November, we are going to see the effects of this inflation trend start. It's going to start by November. I mean, we're trending up, but the impact of this uptrend isn't going to be felt until November, really felt by the public until November, and it'll carry on through 2023, my estimation. How do I make that determination? It's just about data points and stuff that I've been observing in the news. So I'm not doing data analysis where I can document everything from end to end and lay it all out in a chart. It's just my interpretation of what I see going on in markets. The next article is over in the Hatch Ideas channel. Musk accuses Twitter of resisting and thwarting his right to information on fake accounts. I think that he should be shown information on fake accounts. It actually impacts the solvent nature of Twitter. If 50% of the accounts are fake, then it's fake it till you make it kind of mentality, and really exposes the reality of what the social network is. So is Twitter powered by bots and fake accounts? If they are sock puppets that are doing the bidding of the other, 50% of user accounts, then what's going on here? I'm sure that there's a lot of single people that are controlling hundreds, if not thousands, of accounts, particularly when you start getting into the sector of misinformation and political discourse and whatever else. And that's at the level of regular user. When you start getting up into the industrial, the enterprise, the state-controlled account level, that is another animal altogether, where there are people that are out there that have the ability to control tens of thousands of accounts, all from a single shell. And I think that it can be referred to as a clear material breach. So provide the information. And if you're not worried about that information, then make it public. You know, how many accounts? I'm not quite sure why private investors get the information about how many fake accounts exist and you doing something about it, and the reality of the fact that people are interacting with fake accounts. I mean, there was a time I read it somewhere that Reddit had the founders of Reddit created fake accounts to inject comments because nobody would go to a dead site, right? No comments, all the news. That's basically what Ohmtown is right now. There aren't a lot of people that are interacting. The site is seeing a lot of activity, but the interaction isn't there. And that's because people, there's a lot of lurkers. And that's kind of the nature of the beast. But you're not going to get more people interacting. You're not going to get more people signing up if your site is essentially a ghost town. And that was the nature of other social networks that have collapsed. Either they're an echo chamber of the same messaging, and people don't want that. Well, they do, but they want more people saying the same thing that they are saying. Or you have nothing going on in the site at all, and thus it's a ghost town and not worth $45 million or billion dollars or whatever it is. I don't remember anymore. I think it's $45 billion. Anyway, let's click the link. That'll take us over to CNBC. They always have these keynotes, so let's talk about it real quick. Elon Musk. Elon Musk accused Twitter of resisting and thwarting his right to information about fake accounts on the platform. If he's buying, then he needs full accounting. But I think that everybody should get it. If you are subscribed, if you are a member of a social network, you should know how many people are in it and how many are fake and if they're doing something about it, and watch that count of fake accounts go down. Even if it's an estimate, it really should be pinged periodically. Are you a viable account? Are you a viable account? You know, that's what advertisers are actually paying for. If it's the currency that is accounts that are viable, that are operational and engaged and not bots. In a letter to Twitter, a lawyer for Musk called it a clear material breach of the terms of the merger agreement. Musk reserves the right not to complete the deal, the lawyer wrote. I think this might be a way to get that $1 billion or however amount, off the table, because there was supposed to be a cancellation fee in place. It says he wrote in a letter to Twitter chairman Brett Taylor on April 24th, as we discussed, 5420 has been and will remain my best and final offer, period. This is binary. My offer will either be accepted or I will exit my position. He announced in May that his $44 billion purchase of the company would not move forward until he had more information about the number of fake accounts on the service. There you go. Start killing all of those accounts and show the world, Twitter, what's really there. Let me throw this in chat. Sorry for the dead air. I'm going to have to get out of here. The next article is in the Mobile Channel. Time machine simulations created to study the life cycle of ancestor galaxy clusters. For the first time, researchers have created simulations that directly recreate the full life cycle of some of the largest collections of galaxies observed in the distant universe 11 billion years ago, reports a new study in Nature Astronomy. This is all best guess. But I support this. You know, it allows us to look back and see what is really going on in the universe that we inhabit. University of Tokyo wrote this article for phys.org. Cosmological simulations are crucial in determining how the universe came into shape as it is today, but many do not typically match what astronomers observe through telescopes. Most are designed to match the real universe only in a statistical sense. Constrained cosmological simulations, on the other hand, are designed to directly reproduce the structures we actually observe. However, most existing simulations of this kind have been applied to our local universe, meaning close to Earth, but never for observations of the distant universe. Well, this changes the nature of the game by doing a constrained simulation of the cosmos field, so everything that we can possibly see, I suppose. It's like finding an old black and white picture of your grandfather and creating a video of his life, which we can actually do nowadays. In this sense, the researchers took snapshots of young grandparent galaxies in the universe and then fast-forwarded their age to study how clusters of galaxies would form. The light from galaxies the researchers used traveled a distance of 11 billion light years to reach us. So they're reaching back 11 billion years. Pretty neat stuff, folks. Pretty neat stuff. That article is right here. Blink, ba-dum, bunk, blunk. The next article is Dirty Dank and Occasionally Dangerous, What Makes a Dive Bar a Dive Bar. That's in the order of the grape. Set against the rhythm and rituals of closing time at a cafe in Spain, Ernest Hemingway's 1933 short story, A Clean, Well-Lighted Place, features an older unnamed waiter in a losing battle to stave off his existential struggle of loneliness and despair. It isn't difficult to reimagine a modern take on this, maybe a dank and dirty dive. taking place night after night in dive bars across America. So this is going to be an article over at vinepair.com. It's written by Brad Thomas Parsons, and the illustration that's on here is basically of a pool table that looks like it has a broken bottle on it and flying billiard balls, which is dangerous, folks. Really dangerous. Anyway, I'm running really short on time, so I'm going to let you go over to this VinePair article, and let's discuss it in the next episode about the dive bar, because I used to hang out at a bar that some might call a dive bar, but I love the kind of the British pub kind of perspective, everybody hanging out, having a good time. You know, everybody singing songs and closing down the shop at 4 o'clock in the morning, that kind of thing. So I don't know. I love the nature of that. I haven't gone to a bar in I don't know how long though now. So I have to live vicariously through anybody who might be listening. So come back and talk to me about it, but I'll leave the show note. Oh no, I'll have to come back to that. The next article is in the Continuity Report. Russian cinemas go pirate as Hollywood movie pipeline dries up over Ukraine war. So yeah, with the embargo on pretty much everything going into Russia, Russian cinemas are going to go pirate to stave off basically permanent closure. Nick Holdsworth and Vladimir Kozlov is the author of this article over at Variety.com. And it says, after Russian President Vladimir Putin unleashed a brutal assault on Ukraine on February 24th, a war officially dubbed a special military operation, hundreds of major Western corporations, including Hollywood majors, withdrew from Russian markets. And now there's supposed to be a 10-year embargo on them returning, and all of their goods have been nationalized if you exited and didn't take it all with you. So those screenings took place in May, just as controversy rocked the Cannes Film Festival over the inclusion of Russian director Kirill Serebrennikov's Tchaikovsky's Wife in the official selection, although there were noticeably fewer Russians in the Croisette this year. It's understood that some Russian buyers were indeed present. So basically everything that was produced in the West is not being sent over to Russia. And I continue to say that the average Joes in Russia just want to stream here on Twitch and watch YouTube and tweet you know, get drunk and have a good time listening to music and whatnot, and really don't have a dog in the hunt of this conflict, this invasion of Ukraine. You know, to them it doesn't matter, but the regular Joe is what's paying the big price. The next article is in the Hatch Ideas channel. Hackers swipe $360,000 worth of Bored Ape NFTs. And I didn't do it again. So here is the URL for the last article. Here is the URL for the next article. And for those who are listening to this via the podcast, I'm throwing it into the chat so that people can follow it, and it'll be in the show notes so that you can follow it. But yet again, Bored Ape Yacht Club NFTs on the third attack on Yuga Labs since April. $360,000 worth of Bored Ape Yacht Club NFTs have been swiped. So this happens with the frequency of a cheap ham radio to the point where I wouldn't get involved even if I did find that it was something that I was interested in doing. I actually set up an account and whatnot to look at it from the inside, and it's just not for me. This is an article over at Business Insider by Phil Rosen, and I'll just leave the URL in there so that you can take a look at it. It says, the attacks mark the third time someone has been able to infiltrate a Yuga Labs run account to swindle funds. And so the assets aren't worth anything to these people. It's the funds. It's the funds themselves. So a hacker stole about 200 ETH or $360,000 worth of NFTs. And it's that Ethereum. It's that peg to a real currency that is what matters. This can happen to anybody. If you pop up on the radar high enough, you're going to get taken as well. And because this article is referencing the other article about wheat, wheat soars more than 5% as poor U.S. harvest, and India's grain for fertilizer swap deal threaten global supply. So wheat prices rose another 5% today, this morning. And I'm not sure where it's at right now, but it's just increasing at a rate that is untenable for the average Joe to be able to afford a common basic substance such as wheat. I mean, it's the basic for bread. So this is just not going to help anybody during a recession and inflation. The next article, I'm going to keep hustling because I got to get out of here. It's after 12 here on the East Coast, so I've got to go. The next article is in the Hatch Ideas channel. Check out these 27 pitch decks for startups used to raise millions to disrupt advertising. I think that there needs to be more people in advertising. I think that people need to disrupt what amounts to a consolidation of influence in the known advertising channels right now. This is a Business Insider article, and they reference all of the pitch decks throughout it. So I'm going to just post that in the show notes, and then you can go over and check it out. And finally, the last article for today is in Four Wheel Tech, which is all about vehicles and technology. Solid state batteries for EVs move a step closer to production. Solid Power, a Colorado-based battery developer, moved one step closer to producing solid state batteries for electric vehicles on Monday. The company has completed an automated EV cell pilot line with the capacity to make around 15,000 cells per year, which will be used first by Solid Power and then by its OEM partners for testing. The installation of the EV cell pilot line will allow Solid Power, to produce EV scale cells suitable for initiating the formal automotive qualification process. And there is a huge process involved, very expensive, very time-consuming process in getting a vehicle certified, the components certified, then all-in-one certified. It's just amazingly expensive and time-consuming, and time is money, friend. So them changing the dynamic and getting us away from lithium-ion batteries means that there is essentially a safer battery that is coming down the line, but who knows when it's actually going to arrive. So they say in the article, solid-state batteries differ from lithium-ion batteries currently used in EVs, as that they have they've replaced the liquid electrolyte with a solid layer between the anode and cathode. And it says it's an attractive technology for multiple reasons. They have higher energy density. They should be able to charge more quickly, and they're safer as they're not flammable. If you've watched recently on the internet, the bus going up in flames because the batteries were at the top of the bus and something went on, they found a flaw and they're fixing it, but still you don't want to be rained down on by lithium ion batteries that are damn near impossible to put out. You can't put it out with water. At any rate, I'll click the link. It'll take you over to Ars Technica, and Jonathan M. Gitlin is the author of that article. And I may have actually skipped stating who the authors of these other articles are, and I apologize in advance. The pitch deck article was built by Business Insider. The wheat article was by Zara Tayeb. And I think that's where I stopped. So at any rate, I really apologize that I got to rush this last few bits of articles, but I've got to get out of here. and I'll be back at 1 o'clock, and I'll stream the Apple keynote, and hopefully all goes well. I'll see you at 1 o'clock. Thank you very much for coming. This has been Mayor Watt talking about Ohmtown Daily News show here on Twitch. Bye-bye.